I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Thursday, March 5th, 2026. Present today are Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Bynum, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Representative Jimmy, Co-Chair Schrage, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office with us. We have a birthday announcement, but I think I'll wait on that. In today's meeting, we will hear the Department of Corrections present its FY27 budget overview. Then we will welcome the Department of Health back before the committee to summarize and answer questions related to its February 18th update on House Resolution 1, Federal Resolution 1, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and Medicaid Implementation. You might recall that we, because of something in the calendar, who knows what it was on February 18th, were speeding through their slide deck, and I told members that I would bring back the Medicaid and other health officials to answer questions and be available, and I'm keeping that promise or trying to. With us today, shifting back to the first order of business, with us today from the Department of Corrections to present its FY27 budget overview is Jen Winkleman, Commissioner, April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner, and Kevin Worley, Director for the Division of Administrative Services. There are department officers and staff in the room and online available for any committee member questions. Those who are curious, sometimes I do this and sometimes I don't. We have Jake Wyckoff, Dusty Dumont, Jeff Edwards, Zane, who I know is here, Zane Neiswanger, and Travis Welch. And so we have other talent here as well. So Commissioner Winkleman and Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson and ASD Worley, please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation.
Great. Good afternoon. For the record, Jen Winkleman, Commissioner with the Department of Corrections. I want to thank you guys for the opportunity to be here today. Before I turn over the presentation to my team, it was important for me to do a quick introduction. It is an honor of a lifetime to lead a department that I have been with for over 25 years. But beyond my work for DOC, I'm a mom and I'm an Alaskan. And despite caring deeply for DOC, I'd be okay if we were run out of business, because to me that would signify a healthier Alaska. The Department of Corrections is in a state of constant risk containment. We are managing public safety risk, workforce fatigue risk, and fiscal risk. We are a safety net when individuals slip through every other safety net. Most of the individuals we absorb come to us with years of significant trauma, medical and mental health issues, and a lifetime of substance abuse. We are absorbing individuals from more than just the Department of Public Safety. We hold civil commitments when an individual is a danger to themselves or others and there may not be room at local hospitals. We are a huge and important piece of the public safety continuum, and we are expensive. I belong to a nationwide group of correctional leaders, and I recently sat in a teleconference where I heard just about every other commissioner on the call share that they're facing the exact same problems as Alaska. Recruitment challenges and ballooning budgets, driven primarily by overtime and medical costs for those in our care, is a nationwide issue. Finally, I just want to assure the committee and Alaskans that are listening that I challenge my team every day to review operations and see if there is potential for savings, to bring ideas forward and implement change. I will tell you that despite 25 years of caring for this population in our care and custody, and the very complex individuals, it isn't the riots, it isn't the scare of an escapee leaving, because I believe we have good staff in place to take care of that. It is our budget and the fiscal restraint that we are under. So I thank each of you for the opportunity to be here and present our budget.
Thank you, Commissioner. We are joined by Representative Moore, and I'm happy on behalf of the committee to wish her a happy birthday. All right, let's go to slide 2, org chart. Deputy Commissioner.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, and I'm one of the two deputy commissioners within the Department of Corrections. On slide two, you'll see an overall organizational chart of the department. We are broken up into four separate divisions within the agency. And on this chart, you'll also notice that the parole board is, while budgetarily and administratively housed within the Department of Corrections, they do operate autonomously with their daily operations.
Okay. Slide three.
The mission for the department is grounded in the Alaska Constitution, which is to provide the secure confinement, reformative programming, and process of supervised reintegration back into our Alaska communities. This slide reflects how each of the divisions on the lower part of it impact and supports each of those core services. The FY27 Governor's amended budget has a request for 2,127 permanent full-time positions, as well as a budget request of just over $523 million, which Director Worley will go into our budget asks and the changes later in the presentation.
Okay. Slide four, if you're ready.
On slide four, we would like to share some of the unique information within the Alaska Department of Corrections. We are a unified correctional system, which means that we operate both prisons. Typically, those are sentenced individuals, as well as the jail system throughout the state, which is our unsentenced population. And this is really an important item to keep into consideration when you are looking at comparing Alaska numbers and data to other states. On this slide, you also note that in 2025, we booked in just under 26,000 individuals throughout the system. And of that, we booked in just over 16,000 unique individuals, which some of those booked into our facilities more than one time. We have looked at this population historically, and we've experienced in the past where we had one individual that was booked in into a facility over 94 times, which equated to about one booking every week during a three-year period. So we do have several individuals that just repetitively come through the door. An important note is that we have just under 10,000 individuals under our care and custody at any given time, with nearly 4,400 that are in a hard bed. And then on the last bullet, I would like to note that of our pretrial supervision, there is just over 70% of those individuals that are released to pretrial supervision in our communities are on some form of electronic monitoring. And in some cases, they have two pieces of equipment, not just one. And at this time, if there's no questions, I'll turn the presentation over to Director Worley.
Okay, Director Worley, slide five.
All right, thank you very much. My name is Kevin Worley. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. We've been asked to provide a mid-year update for fiscal year 26 as well as the FY27 budget asks. On slide five, we have five bullet items for discussion. The first one is a reduction that we took in institutional personal services for $6 million. This was related primarily to Alaska Correctional Officer Association letter of agreement that we had regarding some double overtime pay related to staffing problems that we were having. So unfortunately, that $6 million wasn't in our base, so that actually reduced our budget by the $6 million. Additionally, we had a reduction based on the closing of the Spring Creek Correctional Center for $7.5 million. That was based on the full closure of that facility. Full closure of one wing of the facility. On item three, we took a reduction on the regional and community jails appropriation that funds 14 community jails. We also had a reduction of five office assistant positions with the related funding tied to three different facilities. And the last item is a $2.6 million increase for community residential centers. Unfortunately, at conference committee, we had a $1.5 million reduction that hit that appropriation, and currently we're in a supplemental request for a little over $1.1 million. Items 1, 2, and 4 on this slide relate to the supplemental that we have for our fiscal year 26. as well as the governor amended ask for fiscal year 27.
ASD Worley, let's talk about residential, regional jails for a moment. And I know Dillingham may be a different item than the other regional jails. Fundamentally, who pays for regional jails? And here I'm thinking of Kotzebue and Nome, et cetera. Do the cities pay for those, or does the state pay for them?
Okay. To the chair. So the department has an appropriation that funds regional and community jails based on the budgets that they provide, and then based on the funding that we have a allocation process. I believe the state pays for a portion of it, not the entire amount of the police and or jail.
And that's sort of what I thought you would say. Strikes me that if Mr. Andreessen from AML were here, he could make a legitimate complaint about that. Certainly, I'm not pointing fingers at you, but all of us, I guess. Municipalities are in part footing the costs of housing state prisoners. True?
Yeah, to the chair, yes.
Any comments? I think it seems a little provocative to me. None are required. All right, let's go to slide 6. Representative Jimmy.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair. How much, when you say that the state pays for a portion, how much of a portion, or is it a percentage or a certain number?
For the record, this is April Wilkerson. There's an allocation percentage that is formula driven. So a couple years ago, the department received intent language, and we created a committee to work with the Alaska Municipal League, as well as some of the chiefs of the police departments, to come up with a more appropriate allocation grid. At the same time, the department started and worked heavily on updating standards associated with the jail standards. So those jail standards were completed and are official as of January of this year. And our director of that division that oversees and the program manager have noticed the jails to come into compliance by July 1st. So we do and will have a better understanding of where operationally challenges are, budget shortfalls are. And we also work through that period of time over the last 2 years to also develop a standardized budget template. We found that there was inconsistencies on what was being requested, what was being funded, as well as what was being included operationally in the calculation and the budget request that came to the department. So we got that standardized. This is the first year we have been able to see a standardized budget between the various jails. And then moving forward, we're hopeful that some of the standards, we are very aware that some of those standards are going to increase operational needs, as well as some that may offset some of the operational needs to give us a better visual into what the needs are of those community jails. I would say that we do have Director Dumont on the line, who was very heavily involved with her staff on the community jail program and the process that we've been under for the last couple of years.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up. Representative Jimmy.
I'd like to thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I'd like to also kind of expand more out to more rural. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, for bringing up regional prisons, how much that question, it raised more questions in my mind too, because people that do get arrested from rural eventually end up in prisons in Alaska. And it sounds like, if I'm understanding correctly, that the state is supposed to pay a portion of it. How would the state help villages that have no police stations or anything, because some don't have any, where there's a crime committed, they have nowhere to place anybody but sit physically with them, some probably in an office, not in a safe situation. But how would the Department of Corrections be able to expand out to communities that have no holding stations?
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you for that question, and through the chair to Representative Jimmy. Currently, the Department of Corrections doesn't have an avenue for that. I'm aware, I think there's about 140 different jails throughout that are not part of the current jail program within the Department of Corrections. And I do believe that there's other holding cells throughout, and those fall currently under the Department of Public Safety. We can provide some more information, but right now we don't have a mechanism other than the legislative process to add individuals into the program. The program that we oversee is more associated with full jail operations and the requirements, and less on the housing or the holding cell type of situation. And I would like to see if the commissioner has anything to add on that.
Commissioner.
For the record, Jen Winkleman, commissioner for the department. I was just going to say that exact thing, that there are, we don't have that piece in there because so many holding cells are run really through the Department of Public Safety. But that is a policy call if that was something to be added to the program as it exists.
Thank you.
Okay, I have Representative Bynum, then Hannon. That's what I see here.
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. I have two questions through the chair. Bullet item number four, this was a FY26 operating budget change. Can you talk a little bit about the impacts of that change and what you may or may not have done to mitigate that issue? And I guess this would probably be for Mr. Burley.
D.C., Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Bynum. The department had received these positions and the funding a few years ago through the conference committee process, and it was added to the budget. We have always received, screened, we were photocopying, but we were using, prior to receiving the office assistant positions, we were using security staff to do that. So as a cost mitigating effort, we had requested and received approval to establish these five positions, and again, through the conference committee process. With the deletion of these positions, we still have a requirement. There's statutory requirement, there's regulatory requirements to process the inmate mail and deliver within a period of time. So to be able to meet those requirements, we now have shifted that back to the security staff to screen, review, ensure there's no contaminated or contrabands coming in through the mail. Before that mail is delivered to the inmate population. We do have Director Neiswanger here from a security element and an institution that can speak more about the mail program.
Yes, follow up, Rep. Bynum.
Thank you. Specifically with that, did that cause a cost shift or additional cost by, I mean, this showed a reduction, but ultimately you're telling me that those activities still were performed. I know that one of the ongoing conversations has been a discussion of overtime and or being able to fill shifts. Is this part of that shift?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, yes. So security has assumed a duty that was being provided by a different position previously that is now increasing our security, higher level positions, whether through overtime or as part of their normal workload, they are performing this now. And it does go into the cost of the positions, yes.
Is a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you. Is there a way that you can quantify what those additional costs, savings, and or additions were because of this change?
Ms. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum. We did look at that. We had a request on the mid-year status report for legislative finance, and we just can't drill down to say actually how much, whether it's overtime or that officer's time, because it's just varied on who's available to meet the need at that point. So we were not able to capture a detailed, I can't say that it was $402,000 or something like that.
Okay, let's move on to, if it's okay, to...
Second question.
Sure. Go ahead, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. One of the other items that was mentioned was we were talking about this perceived cost shift to communities. I mean, we've seen the state do that for other things. An example of that would be cost share to communities for education. When we're talking about that shift where local communities are participating, can you quantify specifically what that was, what that's for, and is it uniform between communities or is it based on facility?
Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, can I clarify, are you speaking to the jail program?
Yes.
It varies because not every jail facility has the same number of beds. They don't have the same setup. Some don't have kitchens. Some are ordering Subway. So there is a variation, but we do have an allocation formula that has been agreed on, and we can provide that to the committee.
Thank you.
I have quite a lineup here. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I wanted to just affirm, because been my subcommittee, I've served on the subcommittee for corrections for 8 years, so I've learned some things. The community jails, we give them a chunk of money, and they are now using a formula to divide it out. But that is not what it costs for the 14 communities that have community jails to run them. So I just want to make sure, even though, you know, it may sound like we're covering their costs, and I believe all 14 community jails that we are, the DOC contracts with, are all in either first-class municipalities or boroughs that have police forces. Dutch Harbor, Kotzebue, Skagway. My community here doesn't have a community jail because we get to use the integrated state jail and prison. And like Deputy Commissioner has said, those jails across the state look vastly different. Some are located in a police department, some are located at City Hall, some are located at, you know, a community center building that has a wide variety, but they happen to have a two-person police department. And communities have asserted that they are picking up a bigger cost and a ballooning cost for continuing to house those inmates until they become Department of Corrections hands. And usually that's a transportation issue. You know, you're maybe 3 to 5 days. There are a few cases where they are held for longer, but in general, they are fairly short stays and then transferred into the DOC custody at a bigger jail prison system. I did want to ask one question about the inmate photocopying, which is when we, the legislature, cut those positions and they were replaced with higher paid staff, corrections officers as opposed to administrative assistants, have you, when you compiled your budget, did you request via OMB to reinstate those positions at a lower pay level because our administrative assistants make less money than our corrections officers? So I want to know if it was lost at your department level or at OMB saying we're not going to let you advocate for reinstating positions that would cost less money in your budget.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I appreciate the question. We did not put forward a request to reestablish the positions. We are looking at our long-term vacancy positions to see what we can truly reallocate and to see if we can contain some cost and reallocate positions to a lower level. We are currently looking to see if we can identify some criminal justice technicians, which would help alleviate their really support positions to the officers and the security, which would be a better fit for the inmate mail program. But it was internally. We did not put anything forward.
Commissioner.
For the record, Jen Winkleman. And I was just going to add, that it isn't always going to be security staff doing the mail either, that every single time the mail comes in, it just does contribute to the overtime because it – And I'll liken it to the kitchen. We have to feed the inmates. And if we don't have kitchen staff, we definitely have security staff and on on scene or in a facility at all times, and so that will contribute to it. But there's going to be days that we will utilize other positions within the facility to lower paying that we aren't just paying a correctional officer to do the mail if the opportunity presents itself. So I just wanted to clarify that on the record.
Okay. Representative Staff, then Allard.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to our wonderful folks at the Department of Corrections. Thanks for being here. So I have two separate questions. First one, on the community and regional jails, it's kind of unclear to me what we're actually paying for. So I'll give you a practical example. I've been in Dillingham Jail, been in the Bristol Bay Borough Jail, been in the Nome Jail. I've been in most of the jails, actually, not because I've done visiting. Thank you, Rep. Allard.
Visiting.
So, you know, if I walk into the Bristol Bay Borough Jail, it's one building. They got the DMV up front at the public entrance. You walk down the hall, they got borough dispatch. If you go to the left, that's where the cells are. At the end of the building is where the troopers are, and borough dispatch is around the corner to the right. That's like the layout of the building. So there's like three different state agencies in the same building. There's the borough police in the same building, and then there's the jails. It's all the same building. Oh, and DMV, which I guess is kind of convenient if you need to get a license before you get booked. But that's the building. We're paying some sort of cost associated with that. I imagine other state agencies have like reimbursable services agreements with the borough because it's all in the same building. So what exactly are you guys paying for when a state, somebody's going to get transferred to state jails in one of their holding cells through the chair?
DC Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, we have a budget outline on what's allowable and not. So normally utilities associated with the holding cells, we're going to pay a portion of that. If you have a building which is only holding cells, we're going to pay all the utilities versus just the portion when we have a shared building site. Some of the dispatch, the food, the basic supplies. We do have that broken out in the budget, the allowable budget items, and we can provide a template to you to show what is allowable and what is not.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Rep. Stem.
Okay, yeah, I think that would be helpful. I guess my thought is, I mean, we talk about how we're cost-shifting on municipalities, but I imagine that the borough is also getting money from the Department of Motor Vehicles and also getting money from the troopers, and I don't know if we're... And it is literally all the same building. Dillingham Jail is very similar, right? Dispatch is at the very top. The cells are at the very bottom in the basement. So I'm just, I'm just curious if we are actually coordinating with our state agencies when we're kind of doing these reimbursements. So shifting gears, my second question, which is this community regional halfway house contracts. I'm just curious, is it supplemental request, $2.6 million, assume you sign new contracts with the third-party vendor. But I noticed in the FY27 appropriation, it's about $1 million less than the 26 supplemental. So what is happening there through the chair?
Pardon me.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, I think the governor's amended is $1.1 million and the supplemental is $1.7 million. This that you see in front of you is what we received in the FY26 budget. So that's the $2.6 million. We had actually requested, I think, about $4.2 million, of which $1.5 million was decremented, leaving us with the $2.6 million. So we started off the year with an overall shortfall based on the negotiated contracts.
Okay.
So there is a supplemental asking to restore a portion of that funding.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Coacher.
Rep. Stafford, D.C. Wilkins.
Yeah, thanks for the clarification. That makes sense. So when I went through and looked at some of these contracts, it seems like some are monthly, some are bed fees, some are some combination between monthly and bed fees. Like, how do you structure those through the chair?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. We have negotiated contracts. They did change the tiered pricing schedule. So... one of our contracts is just a flat bed rate. Everything is all-inclusive. They're administrative, they're overhead. It's one bed rate, whether we fill the beds or not. Then we have five contracts that are in a structured. There's an administrative fee that is paid on a monthly basis, whether the beds are filled or not, and then we pay per bed as we utilize the beds. We still have one contract that is still being negotiated. That should, it's, I think, The RFP closed last week. We're working through that process right now. But the tiered pricing did not work for the vendors, so that wasn't an option as we move forward any longer. So this new rate, the new structure is really, it costs so much just to have the building similar to the jails and what we were just speaking about and our institutions. There's so much cost just to have the building available. And then there's a medium rate based on when you house someone there.
And a final follow-up, Mr. Cook.
Yes, final follow-up.
Yep, thank
Rep. Stafford, D.C. Wilkerson.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Justin, through the chair. In your experience, like, what is better for cost containment then? Is it the kind of monthly fee all-inclusive contract, or is it the actual per-bed, per-utilization through the chair?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, that is... I personally like to pay. If I use it, then I pay for it. If I don't use it, then I don't pay for it. However, in that model, the beds were pretty expensive. We saw some that were over $300 a bed. Doing this other rate, as long as we keep the beds filled, we're seeing a more comparable just over $100 to $200 per bed.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Rep. Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair, a little bit of a doozy one, but you guys have the whole team, so you have a lifeline, so I appreciate that. I was thinking about this yesterday, and I couldn't figure it out. And so you have level guards. Do we call them guards? Correctional officers. So you have 1, 2, 3, and 4? Is that the levels? Okay. So how much are you paying for overtime again?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, I believe our overtime through January was just over about $10
million. $10 million for overtime for 1 year. Okay. How many?
Rep. Allard.
Thank you. I'm going to do a couple follow-ups, Chair, if you don't mind. How many correctional officers do we have in the state?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, about 1,000.
Okay. Thank you. Chair, ma'am.
Rep. Allard.
I guess what I'm trying to find out is we have $10 million in overtime. We have 1,000 correctional officers. Out of those, which ones are level 1, 2, 3, and 4? Because if you have a 4 that's doing time and a half, that pushes the number of the dollars for overtime way up. So isn't it that the unions or somebody renegotiated that you can't just give it to the person that's a level 4, that you have to give it to folks who are level 1 and 2 also?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, the way the overtime report works for that specific union is individuals are allowed to sign up. And so as they sign up, they have a period of time. There's a cutoff for individuals to sign up on the overtime list. Then that site will take the individuals that have signed up, and then it's a random drawing. So a couple of our facilities have a system. They enter the names, and then it spits out, and it puts it in order. And so we are required to go down that order. We call it a WACL list, work assignment. I can get you the acronym, mm-hmm. but we internally call it a WACL list. So individuals sign up. The period of time to sign up is closed. Those individuals that have signed up go down and are put in a list, and then as we have a rotation, we will call and tell them what rotation or what schedule we have. If a 4 ends up in the top of the list, they're going to be called in over that 1 or 2. It's a random drawing.
All right, I'm going to go in just a little bit, just for a second.
Rep. Allard.
Thank you, Chair. So if you have a WACO list, is this in regulation where you guys have this type of format? This is a regulation, not a statute or anything, correct? Yeah.
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, it's within their collective bargaining agreement.
So you're saying the unions have decided that if you're a 4 and you sign up on a WACO list, it doesn't matter if you're a 1. What I'm trying to say is it's kind of wacko because we're trying to save money, but yet we're having a problem with recruiting. So if you're going to give all the 4s all the overtime or potentially a lot of fours, threes, or twos. How are you ever going to keep ones to be able to want to stay when they want to do it? I know it's some random drawing and stuff, but I have a real big concern with it. But you're saying that's a union decision that they negotiated for. It's not something that the DOC has in regulation that you guys have come up with.
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Allard. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's a union decision.
I need facts, though.
It is a contractually negotiated. So when their contract was negotiated, it is okay. Something that was agreed upon by the state and by the union. And Department of Corrections, we are required to follow what was negotiated. I just don't want to say that the union made a decision and we followed it.
I'm looking behind you. Does he have an... may I, Chair? Do they have nothing to participate with it? Okay.
Director Nyswanger would like to say something.
Yeah, I'm feeling like it.
Director Nyswanger.
I just want to try
and
to
then
see...
And we do need to move on. I'm sorry, but we do. Because I can sense sometimes when we're going to get...
In the weeds. And
that things need to be taken off record.
To talk about financial things. Okay.
No. I called up the gentleman you wanted, Mr. Nyswanger.
Okay.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, it's a fair process. So what it is any of the CO1s through fours, and a CO1, just for reference, that's a probationary status, new CO. CO2 is somebody post-probationary. They've completed their FTO training, the field training, officer training. They've gone to the academy. They can all put in for the overtime. And the list is randomized. And so it doesn't mean that a four who's – and I will say there's – just stating a correctional officer four doesn't mean that they're the highest paid employee. There's other things that come into pay structure, like seniority. How long have they been there? You know, what step are they at and what range are they at? But what it really does, the work assignment contact list, is it randomizes all of the staff. So they all have a fair shot at the overtime that's available. And that creates a situation where a four, one of your higher-ranking staff, we call them a staff sergeant, they're not taking all of the overtime. They're not able to take all the overtime. And I think, you know, when we talk about, I just want to point out that if we try to target just the ones get the overtime, what does that say for seniority for the department? So that's a concern. That's where it becomes fair for all staff in those ranks to work that overtime.
Thank you. I was just trying to help with recruitment. Thank you for the leeway. I appreciate
it. You bet.
Thank you, Representative.
You bet. Representative Galvin and then Tomaszewski.
Okay. Hi there. Welcome, and thank you for your work. Through the chair, my questions are, I'm going to just fire them out so that we can try to get through them. My understanding is that additional $24 million is roughly for things like overtime, health care, transportation, and maybe some union contracts. Is that accurate? Am I missing anything?
D.C. Wilkers.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, there's $20 million associated with institutional personal service. So there's two things going into that. There is the vacancies that we are currently occurring, the overtime that we are currently occurring, as well as the vacancy rate that is applied to the institutions. It's pretty high right now. So of the $20 million, just under $14 million is restoring the previously decremented funding, and then the rest is really to true us up with what we're spending currently.
Okay. And then I'd like to ask questions, if I may, around two things. One is the overtime. Secondly is the transportation. On the personal services or how you're doing with recruitment particularly, the last time I was in conversations with you, I believe the deeper one was in Seward. And at that time, I got to hear from leadership there that actually you have a lot of applicants. Applicant pool doesn't seem to be the issue. It's having the right sort of applicants. And I wondered if you could put for the record what it is that you're missing to make sure that you have the full complement of workers that you're looking for. Is there something specific that we can learn about so that we can better appreciate this dollar figure?
Commissioner.
For the record, Jen Winkleman. Very good question. I would also make note that we do not have the applicants anymore like we did a year ago. And so that has really declined. So we've really seen a drop, and unfortunately I don't have a lifeline with our recruitment unit to give us numbers, but we can certainly get that for you offline if that's something you're interested in. But we've really seen a decline in the number of applicants. And as far as where to go with getting them, boy, I would love to answer that. It has been a challenge for us as well. I always say these are tough jobs, but they're very rewarding. Mm-hmm.
Well, what I didn't understand, and I didn't ask at the time, was what was missing? What is the ideal candidate? Just so we can have a sense of whether you can get that in Alaska, or do you need to go search elsewhere? Do you need to offer a lot more money? Like, what is it that do you think, in your studying this issue and problem, have you come up with?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, yes, all of the above. We are currently recruiting out of state. We are looking for individuals that can pass the background, that don't have a felony conviction. We are looking for individuals that can pass the psych evaluation. So there are some Alaska Police Standard Council regulations that we have to ensure that are met. We are looking for that individual that is looking for a rewarding career, as the commissioner said. It's not a job a lot of people want or can do, but those that are on the floor that are serving our population are pretty committed and dedicated. So,
thank you. Through the chair, if I may.
Yes.
Quickly, how many are you trying to hire right now?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, this time last year, we were just under 5% of our vacancies. This year, we are pushing 12%, so we have just over 100 correctional officer positions that we're looking to fill.
Thank you. Through the chair, this question is about transportation, if I may, quickly.
Yes.
This is about the dollars you're spending in transportation, and I know that that is an additional fund now because you have to hire people then to help transport people, make sure you have the right vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. I really saw a lot of that when I visited the 6 different prisons, and sometimes it was a healthcare visit, sometimes it was a court visit. My question is, how far have you dug into changing up policies so that you can have either telehealth or court visits done virtually? Is that something you have dug into and changed, and has it saved you any funds or us any funds?
Commissioner.
For the record, Jen Winkleman, we have absolutely dug into that. And we have done, I will say that some of the infrastructure with regard to internet connectivity within our facilities has been a challenge. But I will say that we have, our medical unit has been using some e-health and telehealth and e-consult to be able to eliminate transports outside the facility, both for security reasons and for the cost avoidance. And we have done the same with the Alaska court system, where we have some tablets and we have a Zoom platform. It's also a matter of whether or not the court in that area wants to see the individual in person, or if they are willing to see it via video as well. So there's to answer the question with regard to cost avoidance, I think we're too early in some of these to really notice it yet. But there are pieces and parts there, sure.
Through the chair, a comment, and
yes,
then I'm done.
Yes.
The comment is, if you need anything from us in order to be more efficient through these ways, which I think you're sharing is more efficient, I'd sure like to know about that down the line. If it's internet, if it's tablets, if it's little spaces that has privacy. I know there's a lot of different issues related to this, and I just wanted to share that I think it's on all of us to make sure we're helping you be more efficient, while not taking away, of course, from true care or justice that sometimes is better served in person. I do appreciate that it's a very big issue, and want to make sure that you know that we're here to help you serve better. Thank you so much.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, through the chair. So my question is going to be, you have a supplemental request over $3 million for medical staff overtime costs. Can you tell me what is your vacancy on your medical staff?
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, they have about a 13% vacancy factor.
Okay.
Follow up?
So 13%. Yes, thank you, co-chair. Through the chair, I see you budget premium pay when you do your premium pay. Can you just kind of give a little definition of what does your department call premium pay? Is that overtime or what is that?
DC Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. That is a great question. So we have four different pots of money that we budget for premium pay. So what you see with the premium pay allocation that's by PCN, that's going to be your holiday pay because the majority of those staff are working a holiday, so they get a premium associated with that. There is also going to be swing differential because of the 24/7 operations. They get additional pay associated with their swing. And then for correctional officers, we do have budgeted their mandatory 60 hours of overtime. So that's what you're going to see at the PCN level for premium pay. Then you're also going to see an area that's called lump sum premium pay. That is going to be our unknown overtime. That's going to be our critical incidents. That's going to be the turnover, the unexpected vacancies within the facility on, as I mentioned earlier, on the WACL list, the work assignment contact list. Those are going to be the individuals that are randomized call in to meet the overtime to maintain the staffing profiles at each of the institutions.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Yes, yeah, so, but not every position gets budgeted premium time, or premium pay, excuse me. Is that correct? So I'm looking at your top 10 most expensive employees in your department right now, and it looks like four of them have premium pay budgeted for the 2026 management plan. So not everyone gets budgeted the premium pay?
DC Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. That is correct. Not everybody. If we know, like with our correctional officers, we know that they're going to work on a holiday. We know that they have this mandatory certain number of hours for training. We know certain elements for that PCN. The other thing that I would add is that as a PCN becomes vacant, that need may shift to another position, which ultimately may increase in another area that wasn't anticipated when we're budgeting by PCN.
Okay, and just one final.
Yes.
In regards to the swing shifts, how often are we doing swing shifts? And do we have the occasion where someone is missing a shift on 1 week and then taking someone else's shift on the same week?
DC Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. So I'm going to go to your first question. One of the drivers that we have seen that the commissioner is pretty adamant about is previously our officers would shift from week on, week off, days and nights. Nationwide, that is not a healthy kind of shift schedule. And so what we have really encouraged at her direction is to really identify where you can and go straight days or straight nights. So there are some positions that are straight days. Every other week, they're on a straight day or straight nights. It's based on need and the availability of that kind of a schedule at that facility. That is one. As far as your second question, I think what you're asking is, is someone calling off of their straight nights and then coming in and working that day shift on that same time period, or?
Clarification.
Clarification.
Tomaszewski for DC Wilkerson.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. I want to know if someone is, if they're using that ability to take someone else's shift and have them switch shifts with someone to in fact, get overtime in the same week. I've heard of these things happening, and I just want to clarify whether that is happening or not. So say I call in sick on Monday, my buddy takes my position. Well, on Friday, my buddy calls in sick, and I take his position. That's kind of the thing that I want to kind of get a little bit of information on.
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. We don't see that. We've looked at it. We've heard the same comments in the past. I remember somebody saying some story from years ago that, oh, the person was seen fishing, but he called in and they were shift swapping. Shift swapping is allowed with approval, so we will allow individuals that need a day off here to swap, but they're still paid at their regular rate, not at overtime. I think what you're referring to is the RDO premium pay. So when an officer comes in on their regular day off, they are guaranteed time and a half on that regular day off, regardless of whether they've met their schedule the prior week or the only time it's not allowed is if they have a pre-approved shift schedule change that they're going to take Wednesday and Thursday off of their regular work week and come work on that on their RDO. So we don't feel that it's being abused. That's something that we are very aware of. We hear about it often, and we try and keep an eye on it.
And just a quick comment.
A quick comment. I'd like to move to the next slide.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Yes.
Thank you for that information. I appreciate that. And I'm glad that you're not doing the one-week nights, one-week days. That would probably drive anybody insane doing those kinds of shifts, especially the hard work that you guys are doing. So thank you for all that.
Okay. Let's get to the operating budget for next year. Mr. Worley.
Kevin Worley, Admin Service Director for Department of Corrections. And slide number 6 is our funding history for fiscal year 27, looking at 25, 26, and the governor amend for 27. You'll see on the very far right column, we're looking at a 9.8% increase over the 25 budget.
Okay. Slide 7.
Slide 7 is just a pie graphical breakdown of where our funding is from, primarily general funds. And we have the three other fund sources listed.
Okay. Slide 8.
Slide number 8 is the breakdown of the operating budget based on the line items. Personal services, obviously, is our biggest since it's a manual. We're a pretty manual process here.
Can you speak more clearly into the mic? I couldn't hear you super well
that.
There. Okay.
Sorry about that.
Mr. Worley, on slide 8.
On slide 8, so this represents the line item or expenditure charges broken down by personal services, yep, commodities, capital outlay. We do have a small segment that's related to travel, but the funds there are primarily for inmate travel, for transportation, and point of arrest.
Okay. Slide 9.
Slide 9 is broken down by division. So, again, institutions being our primary division within the department takes up the biggest portion of the budget, and then it's broken down by health and rehabilitation services. Probation and parole is our third largest, and then admin and support, and then a sliver for parole board and for maintenance.
Slide 10.
Slide 10 is just an information sheet for everybody here so that you could see within each of the divisions within the department what services are provided by that division.
Okay.
Slide 11. So slide 11 is one of the major changes within our budget. This one is a fund swap between the Restorative Justice Fund and UGF. This is an annual adjustment that we do, and it's based primarily on the number of folks that could get a dividend that are currently incarcerated, as well as the dollar amount of the dividend. So in this particular case, I believe it dropped from $1,700 to $1,000. So that's driving this one. Last year, we had a similar split of about 25 or 2.5 million.
Mr. Worley, what is the, let's say it was the good old days and there was a dividend of $2,000. A person was a felon, ineligible for the dividend. Would any of their money go to their minor child as child support, or would it all go into this restorative justice fund?
For the record, April Wilkerson, to the chair, My understanding, and this really might be better answered by the Division of Permanent Fund, but it's the whole thing is swept because they're deemed ineligible under the current statutes.
But no provision for child support that you know of in our current laws?
To the chair, that is my understanding currently. So we do the eligibility list for the PFD allocation, and if they are deemed ineligible, their whole PFD is swept into this restorative justice fund.
Okay, let's go to slide 12. Question from Representative Bynum.
Yes, Co-Chair Justice, I was just going to make a brief comment specifically about that topic. I think this was an issue last year with a piece of legislation that passed through, and the Senate had brought this particular issue up. But this also potentially has an issue with minor children, that a parent would get caught up in this, and that they potentially also would not be getting an eligible dividend, hence the a letter that went with that legislation to talk about this topic. So it is definitely a big issue that we probably should be looking at. So I appreciate you bringing it up.
All right. Slide 12.
Slide 12 again, Kevin Worley, Director of Administrative Services. The first two items are items that have been talked about by other departments at your House Finance Committee presentations related to state shared services of Alaska positions, as well as payroll positions that are coming back to departments. Department of Corrections has one of the harder contracts for timekeeping, so that's going to be coming back to the department. We have eight positions there. The second item relates to the classification study that's currently done, and again, you've heard that from a number of departments. Mm-hmm. Bullet number three, Department of Law was in their presentation for House Finance Committee. Had mentioned a $500,000 transfer of authority from the Department of Corrections to the Department of Law. It's more of an efficiency item. Currently, we do that through an RSA. And then lastly is the increment related to community residential centers for contractual obligations. We do have contracts that have 3 and 2% CPI adjustments to them.
Okay. Slide 13.
Slide 13 is two items related to the governor amend. The first item is the $20 million, and the second item is the 3.1. We've talked about those already at this meeting.
Rep. Bynum.
Co-Chair Justice, in the previous slide and through the chair, the information technology classification study implementation, that's a cost there. But we also had a study that was performed talking about pay rates. Was your department included in that study that came out last year? And if so, have you done anything to implement those pay rates into your pay schedules?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum. The Department of Corrections employees were included as part of that salary study, but there has not been anything that has been fully implemented by Department of Administration for those.
Quick follow-up.
So,
through the chair, so one of the things that we continuously hear is we talk about competitiveness in market, and obviously somebody getting paid according to market is an important part of retention and being able to fill positions. Have you evaluated or expressed your concerns with not having that implemented and how it impacts your department? And if so, to whom?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I have not, to my knowledge, we have not had any conversations. Department of Administration has the lead on the salary study with the implementation of that.
Commissioner Winkleman.
Jen Winkleman, for the record. I was just going to add to that also that in that study, the correctional officer, most of our officer series were found to be paid at or above. Anyway, it hasn't been completely implemented, but the salary study, to my understanding, didn't identify big gaps in pay for our officer series. So more of the administrative tasks, the administrative series, and that's going to be across all state government similarly. So we haven't, to answer your question, no, we haven't had that direct conversation, but the most impacted are going to be the administrative series that are going to show up in every department.
One quick follow-up. Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. So when you, I'm assuming that the department has looked at that compensation study, evaluated that compensation study, and then you either agree with or you disagree with how they came up with the compensation for all of your positions, but specifically your corrections. And is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Slide 14.
For the record, April Wilkerson, one of the things that we have heard a lot over the last several years is just all of the discussions on the growth in the Department of Corrections budget. The commissioner did challenge us to take a look and dive in. And on this slide, what we identified is that since 2016 to 2027, we do have an increase of the UGF of just over $221 million. And we identified the four primary drivers associated with that. And 31%, just over 31%, is specifically associated with the negotiated contracts for the collective bargaining agreements. An additional 23, almost 24%, is specifically associated with fund source changes. Those are the restorative justice, from restorative justice to general fund, from federal authority over to general funds, just to be able to meet and maintain our current operations. So those fund source changes made up an additional almost 24%. And then we saw, just with policy changes and legislative changes, an increase in our general funds of just over 34%. We also saw operational cost of 11% to the governor's amended budget. So $24 million is specifically associated with operational changes. I would say that of that $24 million, the $20 million that we're asking for, or 60% of that amount, the 11%, is really associated with the restoration of the decremented funding from last fiscal year.
Can you say that again, Ms. Wilkerson? It's mostly associated with what?
The reductions in the department's budget. So the $6 million reduction, the $7.5 million reduction, mm-hmm. the $400,000. So of the $24 million, almost $20 million of that is really restoring funds that had been decremented from the budget. So when you really are stepping back and looking at our operational increase in growth, it's really around 5% and not the 11% that's represented here.
Okay. So it sounds like the legislative sandbox, if I can use that term, is the third tower shown here. I don't pretend to be an expert on the fund source changes, but these are fiscal notes that we've generated during that window. Rep Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair. I'm interested in that the big tower, the government policy impacts tower, which is the biggest number on the screen. If I wanted to undo that, would I be able to save $76 million in your guys' operations, or is some of that just kind of built into the cake, so to speak, through the chair?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, one thing we didn't take into consideration, so when we started this slide, we started it with 2016, which was the implementation of Senate Bill 691. So the department did have a substantial reduction in our budget. I didn't add in the supplementals over the years, but I do know that there were some that were offsetting. But we can provide you a list of those legislative changes that make up that 34%.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Cooker.
Follow up, Rep. Stamp.
Yeah, I think that'd be pretty helpful. I mean, how much of, I know SB 91 was partially repealed. How much of that legislation do you still guys at the Department of Corrections still have to kind of deal with through the chair?
D.C. Wilkerson.
So through the chair to Representative Stapp, I have two items, and then I would like to have the commissioner also follow up. There were some elements of 91 that stayed in place, the pretrial supervision That is a unit that is still in place within the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole. We also have litigation that is still requiring us to honor, in certain conditions, the elements of individuals who committed their crime while Senate Bill 91 was in place. So those are two of the challenges that we are faced with right now. And maybe the commissioner can...
Yeah, I think almost all of 91 was deleted. There's stiffer penalties for homicide and sexual assault remained. Mm-hmm. That's probably not a huge surprise. But it was largely gone, or is largely gone. Commissioner.
Yeah. For the record, Jen Winkleman, I would say, kind of piggybacking on what Chair Josephson said to Representative Stapp, the other piece, and it goes to what D.C. Wilkerson said, the individuals that are out on supervision, so out on probation or parole, that committed their offense during the time of SB 91 are still under SB 91 requirements. And so to your point, Representative Josephson, with regard to if they have a technical violation, then they're they have a short turnaround and a short stay in custody, which then requires work on the staff and the courts to turn those back around and get them back out.
Okay. Yes. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, I think Coach Joseph through the chair. Okay. I'm just still struggling to see how that costs $76 million, though, if we repealed most of it, as Kutcher said. And then, I get that obviously there are going to be some people who were committed crimes within that window. So I guess maybe I look forward to seeing your kind of breakdown. Thank you.
Well, the window shown on slide 14 is 11 years, and the bill only existed for 3. So, tell me if I'm reading this right, but cost escalations relate to the fact that we jettisoned the bill quickly. Okay, Rep. Galvin was in the queue, and then Hannon.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you the line of questioning through the chair that I often hear in other departments, particularly education. If you could very briefly go over your consideration of closing down, shutting down some of your facilities and consolidating and the cost differences there, if that's possible. I know they're also different, but I just want to make sure that we have that on the record because the public's wondering, why haven't we figured out a way to curtail our costs here if we haven't seen that many more inmates then that figure this out in a way to restructure? And I know that's what happens in all of our school districts, so I want to make sure to ask you that question. Then I have two more following.
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, we did take a look through the intent language. We prepared a packet, which was provided back to the legislature. You're spot on. Not only are our facilities so different and vastly different, but also the population, anywhere from minimum custody to close custody, which is one of the things that we ran into with the closure of the housing mod in Spring Creek. Ultimately, our recommendation is we really need to do a better and a more thorough evaluation, and not just from the Department of Corrections, but we need to include the legislature, the administration, local law enforcement, public safety, as well as hopefully having a seat at the table to determine what would that look like and what could that look like. There are some local economic impacts that could also be a major factor in this as well.
Okay.
Understood. Thank you. I know that the Seward one especially, a lot of those folks are due to get out pretty soon, and I think what I heard was it was within like 10 years, but maybe I'm wrong on that. No.
Commissioner,
Jen Winkleman, please clarify for the record.
Jen Winkleman, for the record. Now with the house, with the closure of one of the houses at Seward, which was the direction, now
okay.
That is our only max facility on the road system.
Understood. Okay. Thank you for that. If I follow up, that's a different question. This is around...
Rep. Galvin.
Thank you. We've doubled the... amount of vacancies, it sounds like, since last year, whenever I've had my last conversation. And my concern is around what that looks like for the inmates with regard to if this is still true. What I saw one person short in one of the facilities, and they had to shut down the opportunity for those inmates to be able to eat together. They had to miss class that day. You know, things like that happen when you have to reconfigure your staffing. And so it makes me wonder if there's more confinement happening when we are seeing more than twice the amount of vacancies. And that does concern me, and I wanted to ask about that.
Commissioner.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, we have a staffing profile that we attempt to meet, and it is obviously driving the huge amount of overtime. So mm-hmm. as long as we can meet our minimum staffing, then everything is open and operational. I do have, as you know, Director Neiswanger here, and he can speak to it a little more intently, but I would say that in general, it has not, there's going to be those one-off times where we have to take somebody out of the facility and we have to use a staff that's on, and it's going to be a bit before somebody else comes on duty to cover that, to meet that minimum staffing profile. But on a regular basis, no, we are programming and operational as our minimum staffing profile, which is why the overtime is as high as it is.
Thank you for that. And back to the question around the closures. My understanding is Palmer, for example, is more of a minimum facility or minimum maybe to medium. So there are other prisons similar to that where they could go to that are, as I understand, not fully operational, according to the inmates anyhow. I just wondered if you have any comment around Palmer, Sutton, how they're hard to staff, whether or not there's some consideration around that, if you have any comments on that.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, I would just state that Palmer is pretty close to fully staffed. It is also pretty close to full capacity. There are two campuses at Palmer. There is a minimum camp, and there is also a medium facility. So the minimum is a little more barrack style, a little more freedom of movement, where the medium has the fence around the outside.
Got it. Thank you. Final question is, this is just from my observation. On most of the places that I entered, I got the opportunity to experience what it's like to be checked for drugs. And because a lot of what I heard was that drugs are, it's still somehow, or counterbalance, things are getting into the system. And my question then was, why aren't we having a staff as they enter, since it takes like 30 seconds, why aren't they also doing the same check that I got to experience, just to make sure that nothing's being brought in from staff? If it's being done differently, then please share that as well.
Commissioner.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, it is a random, I believe it's random in our policy to do it for staff as well. So it's not an everybody come in and get screened, but it is a random.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And I wish Representative Stapp was here, because when we were talking about the repeal of SB 91, I think some people are mistakenly thinking that meant less pressure on corrections. But my understanding is when we repealed SB 91, in large fact, it meant more people were going to be held in custody and less out on pretrial release. That we were doing away with, under SB 91, there was an idea that if you weren't a violent criminal, let's say you had stolen a truck, that you were going to be released and on a pretrial custody in the community, but that resulted in what I think the headlines of the papers were, a catch-and-release policy. And when we repealed it in 2019, we now have asked corrections to hold you, whether you had committed a violent crime or stolen property. So our pretrial incarceration rate went up. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, yes.
And
follow-up, Rep. Hannon.
Follow-up. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Do you believe that we would have the opportunity with some of that pretrial population that's now in your custody to modify some policies and reduce our costs by having more people out on pretrial. Without statutory change, do we have policies in place that we could reduce that population, or does it require statutory change to be able to put more people out on pretrial release?
Commissioner.
So through the chair to Representative Hannon, a very fair question. Because the pretrial service unit still exists under the Department of Corrections, which was stood up, the individuals that are eligible for release in pretrial are getting out onto that pretrial release. as far as our pretrial population growing in custody, what I am seeing is a much more complicated case and multiple cases, which then make it a little tricky to figure out what policy could really drive that down. But I will continue to think on that.
The court bail schedule, the court has the authority to revise its bail schedule, which is sort of the presumptive rules of the road for release in some ways, right?
Yep.
Yes. And I was going to say the other piece that gets to be tricky is that the court right now has their order in that they're trying to get through that backlog. And so predicting whether or not as they're getting sentenced, then are they getting out or are they staying with us for longer? And figuring out that movement. We saw an increased use of electronic monitoring, as was pointed out even earlier in our slide. We saw increased use in electronic monitoring, particularly during COVID, as an alternative to allowing people to not have to be in a hard bed. And so then we saw individuals being supervised on pretrial electronic monitoring for longer periods of time. So being that downstream agency, we're driven by all these changes from the court, from law, and public defenders that affect ours. So,
okay.
One more on pretrial.
One more, so just so we know, it's 2:52. We have Department of Health officials here, so I'm trying to give them an opportunity.
One more question on pretrial,
okay.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes.
Do you think that we have consistent application of our pretrial interpretation of policies among our pretrial officers? What I'm getting at is, are some of our pretrial offices remanding people who are out on pretrial back into custody over minor infractions where other pretrial supervisors would say, you were 5 minutes late, I'm not going to remand you back into custody?
Commissioner.
Fair question. Through the chair to Representative Hannon. The individuals that are on pretrial supervision are on much stricter. They're on court orders. So the folks that are on probation and parole, there is discretion by the officers. And so when it comes to the pretrial, the court orders to the pretrial supervision, they're black and white on you will report at a certain time, you will report. They have much more strict court orders to follow, essentially.
Rep. Bynum, you can close out with the last question. I want to briefly touch on slide 15, 16, and then let these wonderful people go.
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair. I'm just trying to get a better understanding of what we're trying to demonstrate with this slide. I mean, we're showing, correct me if I'm wrong, this is FY 16 through 27. We're showing the growth for each one of these sections from 16 to 27. Is that correct?
D.C. Wilkerson.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, that is correct. So of the $221 million in general funds, what were the drivers that created that increase?
Correct. So through the chair, with that, have you done an actual evaluation report that we could look at that really talks more in depth about these things? Because these aren't in alignment with cost growth. In general, like we talk about an index like CPI for Anchorage or Alaska in general, these trends don't follow that. And so it'd be really beneficial to be able to actually have a better understanding of what these specific cost growths are, why they were needed, if they weren't
implemented what the consequence cause of not implementing the would have been. Not something that needs to be answered today, but it would be very helpful to actually have that as opposed to just the slide.
Well, and I also would say, for example, looking at the first column, it's guesswork, but it strikes me that that could be about the CPI. If you look at the health care and salary, it seems believable that that could be a 30% bump in 11 years. But
Co-chair.
Yes.
The 31% isn't the bump in that number. The 31% is the share of that total number.
Okay.
So we'd have to actually look at employee compensation and look at it through that period to see if the $68 million is actually a growth from the original.
You're right.
I just don't know.
I was wrong.
Without doing some
information. All right.
So, thank you.
Slide 15.
Thank you. One of the biggest challenges that DOC currently faces is our budget, as we have been discussing. We have shared previously that DOC is a downward agency. Our population and ultimately our budget is driven by outside entities, changes in law, law enforcement, public defender's office, the courts, and it really is tricky to predict. However, the key elements that are associated with what is before you for consideration is the recruitment and retention of our staff. This is, like the commissioner said, it's a nationwide issue, and our sister agencies in the other states are facing the same with staffing, retention, overtime in their budgets. Our department-wide vacancy as of January was at 14.6%, and it is slowly growing. We're doing everything that we can. We're trying to consider and look at how to rebrand our recruitment efforts. The second bullet is the containment of our health care costs. DOC continues to see increases in our health care, and unfortunately, as individuals come into our custody, they no longer qualify for federal services such as Indian Health Care Services, the VA, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those all become the responsibility of the department, and that results in general fund expenditures. And then the maintenance and the upkeep of our aging facilities. All of our facilities are aging. Lemon Creek is a great example. The upkeep and the infrastructure of not only our facilities, but even the technology to operate some of our programming is aging, obsolete, and at end of life. It makes challenging and expensive. It is a challenging and expensive effort that we are faced with on a daily basis and ongoing. And at this time, I'll turn it over to the commissioner for wrap-up.
Commissioner.
Jen Winkleman, commissioner for the department. In the essence of time, I won't go through my examples that I was going to use, but I just wanted to note that the three principles on this slide have guided all of my policy decisions during my time in this position. If we can take care of staff, the rest falls into place. Most of those that are in our care and custody are going to be our neighbors one day. 95% are going to get back out into the community. Not only are we working on reentry efforts being critical inside, it also creates for a safer facility. And then finally, and I think it was Representative Galvin that asked the question earlier about utilizing some of the technology, trying to figure out where we can utilize technology to hopefully create an efficiency and drive down some of these budgetary. So lots of work to be done, but I would assure you that lots is being done. So,
Commissioner,
you.
I want to thank you and your team, ASD Director Worley, Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson. We also heard from Zane Neiswanger. There were, of course, others available as lifelines. You didn't need them, as it turns out. Incidentally, I gave an attagirl to the OMB director a couple weeks ago because she stood up for you guys. And it was pretty impressive, I thought. So we're going to now take a brief at ease. Thank you again. And we're going to change out the slide deck, I think, and we're going to hear from DOH. We'll take an at ease at 2:58.
time issues.
All right. So we, the House Finance Committee, we're back at back on record at 2:59 p.m. Thursday, March 5th, in snowy Juneau. We are here to give you all an opportunity to query the Department of Health. We'll welcome them back before the committee to summarize and answer questions about their update on H.R. 1 as to supplemental nutrition assistance programs and Medicaid implementation. To reset where we were, they speedily went through a presentation. Someone had to leave, probably me, maybe you. And so I wanted to give you all a chance to, because you literally didn't have it, to question Commissioner Hedberg and her Deputy Commissioner Ritchie and the Director of the Division of Public Assistance, Deborah Etheridge, on any questions you had relative to H.R. 1. Commissioner, if you and your team will come forward. You want to, I don't know if this is the same slide deck. You could just give us the lightest touch that may provoke some conversation. Welcome.
Good afternoon. For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner for the Department of Health. And so the slide deck is exactly the same as last week. The focus is on H.R. 1 and the changes in the bill. And so what we were talking about was SNAP, also known as food assistance, and Medicaid. When it comes to SNAP, what we talked about was sort of three primary changes. One is there was an age shift with the able-bodied adults without dependents, and that increased up to ages 64, so it's 18 to 64. The second was the administrative shift. So this is SNAP is a federal program, and the administrative cost is 50% state, 50% federal, and that shift for all states is now 75% state, 25% general funds. And then the third component is the SNAP payment error rate. So states that have a payment error rate that is above 10%, they will need to pay a portion of the federal SNAP benefits. Because our payment error rate is above 15%, we have 2 years to drive that percentage down. And as this committee is well aware of, we've been really focusing very intensely on our staff training, our workflow, and our IT modernization to support that process to drive down our percentages. So that's an overview of SNAP. We can do a brief overview of Medicaid and then go into questions, or we can do questions now on SNAP.
I think we already have one. I guess what's coming to mind for me, and it's not a terribly sophisticated question, but the SNAP error rates, if we're just dogged, we staff up, we have the good software, man, we're on our toes, we're on our game, Monday through Friday, can a SNAP error rate just fall off from 24 to 6%, or is it just not going to work that way?
To the chair, for the record, Heidi Hedberg, that's a great question. And so we are tracking it very closely. What we're seeing is a stabilization, and then the goal is to drive it down, but it's not a light switch. It's not, 24% where we're currently at to 6% next year, because these calculations are based off of a federal fiscal year, but we receive it on the state fiscal year, and we have to look at what is causing those error rates. And those error rates can happen by the eligibility technician or the client, right? A lot of it, and I can briefly share with you the the sort of top focus areas that we've been working on. It's either missing reports, it's household composition or wages and salary. Those are sort of the top sort of global three elements that sort of make up sort of those error rates. So as you had identified, the staffing training, staffing support, working on automation of a lot of that work to identify early when we're missing information or it's inaccurate so that we can correct it early on will help reduce that error rate.
Okay. In the queue, we have Rep. Stapp and then Galvin.
Thank you, Coach Justin, to the chair, to Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner. Good to see you. Can you get it below 10% by the FY28 to the chair?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, that is the goal. I don't have a crystal ball, and so I can't predict what it's going to be in 2 years. But I would want to make sure that the committee understands the focus for the 2 years is critically important that we drive it down, because the error rate in 2028 is going to the error rate of 2027 will set the rate for 2030, and that's when, if it is above 10%, or above 6%, will have to pay a portion of the SNAP benefits.
A fault, Mr. Coacher.
Rep. Stapp for the commissioner.
Yeah, that increases exponentially, though. So obviously, you know, I know you have a slide later, but greater than 10% is like $42 million, and less than 10% is like $28 million. So there's a substantial difference in getting below that 10% number. Second question, simple math. Cost of resources to fix this, is it lesser or greater than cost of penalty to incur? Through the chair.
Interesting. Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, I think we probably have to follow up with you. I mean, right now there's a lot. We have the funding, and we're working on the focus areas of the training, the quality, and the IT changes. So I think we would follow up with you, but I would say that it's cheaper to fix it now than it is later on.
Okay, thanks.
Rep. Galvin.
Thank you. I'm going to just piggyback onto that one and ask us, if I may, through the chair, if you have a history of, let's say, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, what the error rate was 15 years ago.
Commissioner Hedberg.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative. I do have the history, and it is publicly available. In 2011 to 2014, it was below 2%, although as we have been looking back in our history, one, I want to make sure that that we would follow up with the committee to understand why that rate was so low, because it was a different calculation, and there was contractors that were supporting that calculation. So I think I don't want to misrepresent where we were in that time period. None of us were in our roles during that time period, but that's what's reflected in the documents.
Okay. So thank you. 2011 to 2014 or 15 was below 2%. And then after that, I think we let go of 100 workers in the Department of Health. Is that correct? Sometime after that?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative. So I think two separate issues. So there is a document that we can follow up and we can share with a history information of why the rate was so low. And what you will see is that the federal agency, USDA, and Food Nutrition Services, FNS, is the one that administers the SNAP program. They changed their calculation. And I think that's really important for the committee to know, that the calculation was changed in 2015 and 2016, so it's very different. You're not comparing apples to apples. And they paused the calculations during the pandemic, and that was 2020 to 2021. And so I think it's important to look at the entire totality of the history, right, in terms of the calculation, what was causing those error rates. There was a reduction in positions, and that occurred, I believe, in 2022, in that time frame.
Through the chair, follow up, if I may. So,
yes, I'm trying to think. Could have been slightly earlier than 2022, but that's about right.
Yeah.
Rep. Gallagher.
Yeah, I think it happened before I came, so I think perhaps.
Yeah.
It must have been before that. Mm-hmm. And I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is that when I came to this table, it was a question of getting us some hardware and some software, and then also after that it was more employees. And so I'm trying to piece together the history, as it sounds like you are also doing. And I would appreciate understanding better. If they've changed that full calculation, then I get it. They must have really changed it for us to have swung an entirely, you know, like we're talking about double digits, that now we have to scrape back to getting to. So that's rough. And I'm trying to appreciate that you're trying to change systems too, so that it's cleaner and I think more efficient or needs fewer people. And yet we're in that middle zone where how do we at least scrape in enough to where we're not being fined as much as we are. And so Representative Staff hit it right on the spot where he's like, well, should we just be paying, just continue to pay these high fines, or should we try to clean up the way we're doing it? And of course, I can understand you're wanting to get to a better system that has more integrity in it. But I want to understand the history, because somehow back then, when they did have more people, and it may not have been related at all to this, but I think about how hard it is for so many of the people who call me. And you've been very helpful to let me know your call times have been reduced, although it's still oftentimes over an hour and such. But they don't understand things like they can be called back. They don't trust that. There's a lot of things going on that I think requires people. And, you know, just because of the vulnerable position they're in, I think that it's a really difficult place that you're in to deliver this service of a pass-through in a way that has such integrity. So I want to make sure that we appreciate that, and in the response that I received about the wait times, about the call times, what I was missing was what your goals are. Mm-hmm. So I would love to see that, and then we can kind of see how everyone is progressing in a way that's getting to where the goal of whatever time frame makes sense is happening. So that's my question, is if you could provide that as you have time.
Commissioner.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, yes, we will follow up with the call times. And I do want to thank the committee. We did receive 15 new PCNs last year. Mm-hmm. And I just heard a report that of those 15, 13 of them are filled. They're in training. Two of them are in the final stages. So I think it's this balance right now with what is the right staff ratio for the volume of work that we have, and we have an agile implementation of our IT modernization. So as more systems come on and more systems are automated, how do we retrain our staff as they are meeting the client and making sure that we're getting that accurate information? And so that is this balance that we're in right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
Rep Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair, just to remind simple explanation or definition of error rate.
Commissioner, sorry.
Yes, through the chair, Representative. So the payment error rate is not a measure of fraud. It is a measure of mistakes that can be made by the eligibility technician or the client, and they include administrative errors, missing or inaccurate information, or misapplied policy.
Okay. Follow up?
Follow up. Rep Bynum.
So it's possible that you might have somebody receiving a benefit, and when you go to fill out the paperwork for that, this person's absolutely 100% eligible for that benefit. They actually received the benefit, but maybe something is not filled out correctly in the application process. That would be considered an error.
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, you are correct.
And then the consequence.
Rep Bynum for the commissioner.
As a follow-up, the consequence of that that error is what we're looking at here, is these penalties from the federal government, correct?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, yes, you are correct. Okay. I would say that we do measure our error rate by eligibility technician and by client, and it does change year to year. The last time that I looked, it was about 30% for our clients.
Okay.
Okay.
Follow-up, Rep. Bynum.
Thank you. So how, who's making the determination that an error actually occurred? Is that happening, are we self-reporting that error, or is there, is it audited through the federal government? Like, how is it, it seems odd to me that we're basically saying that there's an error being made, so somebody's tracking this and saying, yes, that's a mistake, and then applying this to some rate. If we have the enough accuracy to determine that a mistake is made, I would say that we probably have enough accuracy to prevent the mistake from the beginning. So I'm just trying to understand who's actually tracking that there's mistakes being made.
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, what I'd like to do is call up the director. We do have an integrity unit that follows federal rules and federal guidance, and they're pulling samples of cases, and they're auditing those cases, and then we need to report that back to the feds. I don't know if that's a sufficient answer. If you have further questions, the director needs to answer.
Through the chair, I can get that. If I can just get that information provided to the committee, that would be more helpful, or that would be helpful, and then I don't need it now. And then one other follow-up question.
Follow-up, Rep. Bynum for the commissioner.
Thank you, through the chair. The when we talk about this error, you'd indicated it felt like that there was a 30% error on our part, meaning the state administering the program. I would assume then that means that the person applying for this program was responsible for the 70% of the errors that we're seeing. And then we pay a potentially, it looks like we could potentially be paying $42 million worth of penalties or cost to us. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, it's opposite. So it's 70% client. I'm sorry, 70% eligibility technician, 30% client.
Okay. Thank you for the correction on that. And then one final follow-up.
Final follow-up. Rep. Bynum for the commissioner.
Thank you. Through the chair, do we identify, do we have tracking of when these errors are occurring statistically? Let me back up. You've identified that there's 30% error happening by the person applying for the program. 70% of the errors are by our folks taking the information. My understanding would be that that can obviously change from year to year. My guess is those trends would probably be pretty close to each other. But do we do demographic data, understanding of where these are actually occurring, if they're occurring from the people that are applying? So, for example, younger people applying for the program might not be doing it correctly, or older people applying for the program. And then secondly to that, is there a difference in the program for when we did expansion or adding people to the program? Do we did that contribute to the error rates as well?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, I would have to follow up with you on that specific, on those two specific questions. The process is cases are processed and they are randomly selected and audited, and those audit measures are indicated by the federal agency. And so if there's an issue, everything is reported, and so there is a monthly process that happens. And again, we can follow up with the committee on what that process is. In terms of the demographics, I don't know if we are trending or looking at the demographics. We're looking at what the causes of those errors are and the corrective actions to those errors. And over the past 2 years, we have stood up a committee that is, in addition to the program integrity, looking at the workflow and how to have early identification and early correction of those errors. And that is stood up and that is working right now.
Thank you.
So my staff reminds me that indeed it was FY22, the governor budget deleted apparently 121 positions. I have some memory of 99 or 100. And I also have memory of the subcommittee, because I think Rep. Sponholz was here at the time, that we were very, very alarmed by that. I thought we tried to reduce it to 50, but that would have been at the subcommittee phase, and it could have gotten, I'll put in air quotes, worse from there. But we, our hunch, our collective hunch was that this was not good, and I don't think it was. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. I just wondered if, since we know now that we've rehired or hired new positions and we're at least 13 of them in and working, could you give us a sense of how that's going, if that's enough, if you're seeing such a a great increase in terms of the quantity and quality of the work that's happening now with them. Could you imagine needing more? And I'm asking that at this time because we want to make sure that if that is what you're looking for, that we're helping you meet the need, not necessarily what you're looking for, but if it is what we learn is necessary. And to Representative Bynum's point around data around the demographics, it'd be interesting to hear if people just have a hard time figuring out how to answer these questions and maybe need more of a hand-holding time period with a person. And I may be completely wrong on this, but I know for me, I don't fill out those forms online. It's always my husband because I get so frustrated. Like, why are they, you know, asking me this in this way because I don't think the same way as forms do? And so I bring that up because I know that for some people, it's just an interesting question, and that begs a question around whether or not, another 15. I've heard at one point that you really can't take on more than that per year, but are we now at the space and time where it makes sense to bring on more help?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, I think that's a great question. I think we are asking ourselves the same questions. Right now, in the calendar year of 2025, we saw a lot of changes within our staffing positions. A lot of our staff were moving up in the ranks, and we were bringing on new staff. The calendar year of 2026, we've seen a lot of stabilization of our staff, and we know that retention of our staff increases the quality because these are very complex programs to train to, and we've overhauled our training program, and now we're focusing in on the quality of the work and identifying the mistakes early so that they can be corrected. And so, the working premise that we have with the division is that we still have vacancies, and we need to fill those vacancies and reevaluate if we need new positions. And so our focus right now is filling those vacancies.
Thank you.
So I'm looking at a report that indicates that eligibility techs, for example, in 2020, there were 310 with 253 filled. That fell to, if you help me remember the number, the committee should remember the number, 253. That fell to 198 the next year in 2022. Substantial drop. And now we're at 218. We were at 243 a couple of years ago. So it ebbs and flows a bit. Rep Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair, really quick, can you remind us how many people are participating in the program, approximately?
Commissioner, how many people in the program?
Through the chair, Representative, so there's roughly about 65,000 households. 65,000 individuals, which is about 30,000-ish households. That number changes month to month. On our website, we do have a dashboard that reflects how many are on each different public assistance program.
Thank you.
Okay. Pardon me. All right. Rep Snap. Staff.
Hey, that works, Co-Chair. I'll be snappy, though, I tell
yes.
you what. Through the chair to Commissioner D.C. Ritchie, just out of curiosity, I don't expect you to know the answer, but this total number of eligibility technicians through the total amount of programs that we administer, how does that kind of compare to another state's kind of entitlement system, right? Do we have more or less eligibility techs on the aggregate? Because I think that would be probably the easiest way to kind of benchmark how we are ranking, because I imagine most of the programs are very similar to enroll state by state, through the chair.
D.C. Ritchie.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health and Representative Stapp. Maybe I'll take a first swing at this and see if Commissioner wants to add anything. Every state kind of does it differently, right? I mean, we tend to have all of our programs together in one division that is processing eligibility, but you don't have what they call integrated eligibility in every state. So it's different with every state. I think the other element here that's really important to understand is clearly we need technicians and individuals to do this work, but we also need technology systems that support them. And so in other states, you may have different technology systems that are maybe more efficient or are more modern that can help support the technicians in being more effective with their work and also can support individuals who are applying in helping make sure that those forms are more complete when they do apply. Representative Galvin, I am like you. I am probably a great person to test technology because my patience is very thin on completing those forms. And so I think the role of technology in the IT system is really important to highlight for the committee as well, because we received $52 million just about 2.5 years ago now from the legislature that we have been using to update our Medicaid and our SNAP eligibility systems, one of which, the SNAP system, I know the committee knows this, but I just want to remind everyone, it went live in 1983, right? It's DOS. It doesn't have a mouse. Those updates are happening. They are on time and they are on budget, and they're happening through an iterative process. This agile process is a different approach where instead of waiting until the very end for a single go live date, they are able to issue smaller contracts, complete the work, and stand those up over an incremental period of time. So part of what the division is trying to balance when they think about staffing is not just when the IT system comes online, you know, finally 3 years from now, but as new elements of that system are developed and put forward, those can help individuals access benefits more effectively, like what we've seen with the SNAP online benefit form. But I think in this next year, you're going to see technicians be able to have, a much better working environment because they're going to be able to have some consolidation in the tools that they have to support. And so it's kind of balancing all of those components as they're shifting. We're really in this transition period, but it does take time.
Yes, follow up. Rep Staff.
Yep, thank you.
On SNAP.
Yep, be a quick, snappy follow up here, Co Chair. Thank you through the chair to DC Ritchie. I appreciate the answer. I guess to me, it's been a long process for both of you guys, and I always want to say you are really excellent in the roles that you have both done. So I remember when I got in this building, I think dumpster fire was probably like a kind understatement of what we were kind of dealing with. And it is nice to be able to see light at the end of the tunnel. So my last question to you is there anything else that we could consider here at the Finance Committee to help you kind of navigate through this process better through the chair?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, I think that's a great question. I think elevating the work that is happening, I think, is critically important. It's not financially related, but I think constituents need to know the changes that are happening both in Medicaid and in SNAP. I think also just tracking the awareness of all of the system changes that are going to be happening in the calendar year of 2026. We've been talking a lot about the intense focus around staffing and training for public assistance in SNAP, but there's also a lot of changes within Medicaid, and we're going to start ramping up our communication around the Medicaid changes this spring so that Alaskans are aware of these changes and how to appropriately engage with that.
Okay. Rep Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Really quick, have you guys looked at what other states are doing successfully? So, for example, South Dakota, Idaho, Wisconsin, some of these states that have really low error rates, have you coordinated, has your department coordinated with them and talked with them, like, what are you guys actually doing that's working well? And then are we emulating that?
Commissioner.
Through the chair, Representative, yes, the director for DPA, Director Etheridge, is working very closely with the other states. There's a lot of knowledge sharing of the best practices and what's working. I think to DC Ritchie's comments earlier, when you see one program, you see one program. Every state administers these programs differently. And we have been on our heels for decades in IT modernization, and now we are leaning forward in this proactive nature around IT modernization. And that really has just been in the last 2 years.
Thank you. Okay. Probably a good place for us to stop. DC Ritchie and Commissioner, I hope you didn't fly all the way here just for this little Finance Committee follow-up. Were you here in town anyway? Okay, it's good to know. All right.
We appreciate you coming back a second, probably a third time. I want to thank Commissioner Hedberg and Deputy Commissioner Ritchie, Director Etheridge, for their presentations. That concludes our business for today. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, March 6th at 1:30 p.m. At that meeting, we will have our first hearing on House Finance Subcommittee closeout reports. We're going to adjourn today at 3:29. We're adjourned at 3:29.